Peter?
You get by Russell S. or Russell Spatz?
Russell S.
Okay. Russell S. from the Coral Gables Group.
Good evening. My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Coral Gables Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's great to be back here again. I think I just finished a step series here about 7-8 months ago, and I think Steve D's up here now, right? Stevie B? And is he in the audience? No. Well, I'll tell you what, there's a bunch of people here that first of all, I want to give a shout out. I got a call from Nelson L. He told me to give a shout out to all his friends here. I see as nobody here really cares. I've known Nelson for years. I figured that was going to happen, but I told him I'd do it anyway. He said he'd give me $25 if I did, so got that done with. See John there. It's good to see you, John. You know, and I saw Lou Garsh. Where's Lou? Lou, where are you? Over here. You know, I don't know how many people know. You know, Lou had 3,000 years when I came in here 30 years ago. And he's got like 47 years now. You know, you can drink now. You know, don't make this thing an obsession. Go out and have a brewski or something, you know. Come on, you know, forget it. What? I'm not supposed to use your second name? Well, I guess I blew that shit, you know. At the end of that deal. What can I tell you? I know, I love you too. Lovely wives here. I got a bunch of guys. I get to give a medallion out tonight to one of my guys, you know. He's kind of crazy. And I see this isn't exactly Well People's Anonymous, so I can see that. So it's good. It is good to be back here. Actually, what is this, like an old-timers meeting? I haven't found necessarily have a drink since January 17th, 1981. So, but actually, that's not an old-timer in AA. I don't know what that is, because I went to the International Convention in wherever it was, San Antonio. San Antonio, right? And they have this this table. It's an old-timers table. So, you know, just for the heck of it, I figured I'd mosey. You know, I feel like doing this meeting on things my sponsors. I've had three sponsors because not that they drank or anything, but they, you know how people say, "Will you be my temporary sponsor?" I say I wish I could make it permanent because they die on you. You know what I mean? It's not their fault. You know, they stay sober, but they get older and we all pass away. And you know, my first sponsor was Bob Sullivan, a wonderful man, and he died after many years. And then Joe Snyder, who Lou and I were very good friends with, and I loved him very much. And I think Joe died with like 35 or 36 years sobriety. And my current sponsor is John Glenn. He's got about 55 years. And all those, when you hang around with guys like that, they in turn introduce you to other mentors and other people that are not technically your sponsor, but you hang out with them and you get to know them, guys like Ray O'Keefe. And, you know, most of the people that were old-timers when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous 30 years ago, you know, they're all gone now. As a matter of fact, most of the rooms that I used to go to are no longer in existence. I think there's maybe one or two rooms. I think West Miami is in existence. We used to all go to the Arch Creek. Is the Arch Creek group still around? We used to go every Saturday night to the Arch Creek group, and Ray would be there, and you know, they're not around anymore. But I learned a lot. Well, I might do a little something on that. You know, you never want to really base your sobriety on anything that might not be around anymore. You don't want to base your sobriety on a wife, as much as I love my wife. You don't want to base your sobriety on your kids. You don't want to base your sobriety on a medallion. I've lost the meaning of these things. You don't want to base it on a job. You don't even want to base it on a sponsor. You don't want to base it on anything that can die or be taken away or that the IRS can grab or can divorce you or can get mad at you or you can wake up one morning and say, where did I put that thing, you know, or can rust or anything. You want to base this thing on something that nobody could ever take away from you and you can never lose it. You would have to piss it away yourself. You'd have to throw it away yourself. But I learned that after a whole bunch of years, because I'm such an alcoholic, I'm so used to putting my faith in stuff, and whoring myself for stuff, you know, for women, for relationships, and prostituting my ideals for stuff. And you know, when you prostitute your ideals for stuff, when you become a stuff addict, a stuffaholic, you know what I mean? What that means is that you're always scared, and you're always in fear, because you know something, you got no control over the stuff, and the world has a way of sort of taking away that stuff and threatening that stuff, and then you spend a lot of time thinking at 3 o'clock in the morning, what am I going to do about my stuff? And what's going to happen if they take away my stuff? And where am I to get more stuff, you know? And you may not drink, but you feel like crap most of the time. Because your whole life is about stuff that isn't even important. But you think it's important, you know? So, but that's not even what I want to talk. I'm going to talk about some other stuff, but something else. I don't even know. I had a great meeting planned. You should, at 9 o'clock in the morning, I did it all in my mind. It was wonderful. You would have loved it, but I forgot it. But when you get into your 60s, but in any event, I think what I was saying is I was at this old-timers thing. My sponsors told me all sorts of crazy things. And, you know, one of my sponsors, I remember Joe Snyder told me, says, Joe Snyder says, I don't consider you sober until you have 10 years. So I had 10 years. I got 10 years. And I said, I got 10 years now. He says, I meant 20. You know, they do stuff like that. They move the goalposts. So I went over to the old-timers table, you know, because I was coming up on 30 years at that time, about a year ago, something like that. And I said, so what does it take? I don't know what it was. So I said, what does it take to be an old-timer? He says, 40. You got to have 40. But apparently, I went to a meeting this morning every Saturday, and I learned something, you know. I mean, I've heard this many times, but I'd actually sunk in. Apparently, I don't know what the saying is because I don't say it much. What is it? You know, the most sober guy in here is the one who got up earliest in the morning or something. You ever hear that stuff?
Yeah.
You never heard that before?
Yeah. Yes.
What is it? What is it? The most sober guy? What is it? Can anybody tell me what the saying is? Whoever woke up the early. So I want to make sure I understand this correctly. Some sniveling, thumb sucking, whack job woke up at 3:30 in the morning with a gun in his mouth. You know what I mean? And because I got up at 9 and slept like a baby, you know, this guy's more sober than, like, 30 years is bullshit. Is that what, that's what you're trying to, I mean, I don't even know what the point is then, you know, staying sober. You know, alcoholics believe all sorts of crap, you know, because they want to believe all sorts of, well, I understand what that means. There's a certain amount of truth in that, you know. You see, that's the problem with being an alcoholic. You see, it's sort of like this, I'm conflicted. Because there's a part of me that wants to believe that. I got to believe that. Because the truth is, this is a one day at a time thing, and I can lose my sobriety like that, and I got to be fresh and on top of it, and I can never rest on my laurels and say, I got 30 years, I'll never drink, because I'll be drunk in a half an hour, and I believe that. Okay, so I got to really buy into that stuff, that this is a one day at a time thing, and don't think you're so big because you got 30 years. On the other hand, you know, I believe what my sponsor said. You know, when a man with experience meets a man with money, the man with experience will walk away with the money, and the man with the money will have walked away with an experience. You know, experience brings wisdom. It means something. It means something, you know, to be sober. You know what it means? It means I know what it's like to be sober bored. I know what it's like to be sober while you're disappointed. I know what it's like to be sober when the check bounces. I know what it's like to be sober when you have no money. I know what it's like to be sober when you're flush with money. I know what it's like to be sober when you think your world's coming to an end, when the IRS is coming again. I know what it's like to be sober when you got cancer and they're doing radiation therapy on you. I know what it's like to be sober when there's people dying around you, like a sponsor and people you love. I know what it's like to be sober when maybe you lose your job. I know what it's like to be sober in life while stuff is happening to you that isn't all that good. And whatever that deal is that I'm talking about that you're going through now, I've gone through it, you know, 3,000 times. And in order to really get this AA thing, it's nice to think you can do it in your brain, and you do it with a book, and you do it with a sponsor, and you do it with a group, but you really got to do it. It's not an laboratory experience where you do it in a classroom. You really got to do this thing hands-on, clinically, on the job, in life, over a period of 10, 20, 30 years to really see how it pans out and really get the deal. Because there ain't nothing. I can talk to you about a lot of things. I can say a lot of things to you. You can read the book. You can memorize the book and everything. But there ain't nothing like losing your job, having no money, having your house foreclosed on, and having four kids and a wife and not knowing where the next dime's going to come from and trying to stay sober too and going through that about 3 or 4 times. You got to do that deal. Because, you know, around here, when all is said and done, there's going to be a lot more said than done. The proof is really in the pudding, whether you stick around. And then somehow, some way, what you learn, and it's a tough thing, they say it in the seventh step, we learned the value of suffering. You know, they say how we get a new perspective here. It says, by 1,000 forms of humiliation, the final crushing of our self-sufficiency. And apparently the most important thing here is to gain some sort of humility. And I don't know anything about humility. I know about being a big shot, and I know big shotism. I know being, you know, smarter than anybody, and I know all about arrogance. I don't know much about humility. I think there have been times that I've been humble, but the only time I can remember when I've been humble was always at the heels of being humiliated. And so you start learning the value of humiliation at the hands of a sponsor, at the hands of a group, at the hands of life, at the hands of a boss. Humiliate. You learn the value of that, that character building. And you start somehow learning, and you only you coming up on it when you have 1 year or 3 months or 2 years or 5 years, that sounds like crap. And I'll tell you something. When you're going through a horrible time, and you're going through a terrible time, and you think your life is over, and you're sober, and some old fart tells you you're exactly where you want to be, and you want to beat the crap out of him because he doesn't understand until you have 10, 20, 30 years, and you understand that you're exactly where you're supposed to be. And somehow along the way, although it doesn't make any sense because you wish, like I wish, that we could do this thing sitting on a yacht, you know, drinking a malted milk with a couple of blondes or something like that and never have any problems, you know, but that's not the deal. That's not how it works in here. As a matter of fact, the bottom line is everybody who gets what they want in here, as much as they want here, ends up going out drinking. That's what I see. The people I see, the people get too well too fast and get everything with no consequences and have a lot to fall back on and never have any financial or monetary problems. I'm not saying they never stay sober. They have a tough time. They have a tougher time than the people who have to go through crap. And so somehow, some way, you prove this stuff to yourself, and so you could see it in other people. You see it from people who talk on the witness stand here, because when people get up and they talk about stuff, there's something about the way they share. Like I used to watch people the way they share, and you know they're authentic. I mean, I love one of the major books that they read in Alcoholics Anonymous during the first 4 years. Of course, all they read was the Bible, but the books they concentrated on was 1 Corinthians 13, the Book of James, and Sermon on the Mount. And when I came in here, as well as many years before that, they used to hand out Emmett Fox's Sermon on the Mount. I got it, and you had to read it. And of course, the last line in Sermon on the Mount, when you know Jesus was doing his 12-step meetings and stuff like that on the Mount, the last line they said, and the people were amazed because he spoke with authority and not like the scribes. So whereas the scribes would sort of, the people would get up there and sort of tell them what to do and everything, this guy spoke in such a way so that people's hearts were moved. Because he said, that guy's telling the truth. And something about people, when they talk about their own experiences and what happens to them here, communicates to any alcoholic who is serious about this thing and wants this deal. You can't communicate to anybody who doesn't really want this deal. It's just sort of showing up to show up. But what communicates to people is that this is the truth. This guy's being legitimate and telling you the truth. And being, I mean, they don't pay enough to lie in here. You know, and so what happens is, you know, I come in here and I listen to these people, and you may see this thing in other people, and you may see the experience, and you may listen to other people, but it's not until you do it yourself and you see it start working on your insides and you see the transformations, do you actually get, and you may not see it at first. Other people may point it out to you. You look better. You acted better. You did that. This comes to you like inspirationally, like in surprises every 6 months, every year, every 2 years. All of a sudden, and all the dreck with all the bullshit and all the crap that's going on, you don't even know what you're doing. One day, 1 hour, 1 second, you say, holy shit, I can't believe I did that. I'm getting better. And then it's on to the next bullshit thing, you know. And then a year later, after all the struggle, you come up here and you say, man, I'm getting better still, you know. And then all of a sudden, you start realizing that with all the crap you're taking, and all the broken promises, and all the disappointments, and all the everything that's going on, that somehow along the way, that all fed into the deal, where even with the bad stuff, ended up good things happening. You know, in the book of Genesis, it says they met, you know, one of the whole lessons of the book of Genesis is Joshua, the kid with many colors. You don't have to remember all this, but the bottom line is he says to his brother, he says, you know, you meant it for bad, but the Lord used it for good. And how many times in here do bad things happen to people, or we think we perceive them as being bad because we don't get our ways because we're sort of childish, and all of a sudden 6 months down the road we're talking from the podium, we're saying, you know, it's the best thing that ever happened to me. And we see that thing over and over and over again. By the time you get to the 50,000th time where you were disappointed once again and the check didn't come in or the check bounced or the person disappointed it and somehow you got through it and you got through it okay and everything worked out, and because of that, you changed and worked out, and you finally, it's not an intellectual thing, you finally realize it's part of your DNA that there ain't no bad crap. That even the bad stuff works for His glory and works for your good, and all things work for good for those who really focus on God and have a relationship with Him. And I'm going to tell you something, when you start understanding that even bad crap is absolutely good when you're focused on the right deal, you never have a bad day. I'm telling you, and I can't explain that to you, but you want to know something? According to A statistics, 20 years from now, 1 or 2% of you guys are probably going to be sober, and you might remember what I'm saying. And say that guy was right. Or maybe all of you, I don't know. So in any event, I came into Alcoholics. I don't know, one day I got down, one day, 31 years ago. I think it was Christmas Day, early morning, 3 o'clock in the morning. And I had just gotten kicked out of a party. I had long since left my first wife, left that child. I was in my bachelor pad. And all alone, as usual, as I had been my entire life. You know, most people live lives of quiet desperation, even after they come to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's a whole other thing about the being alone and loneliness and belonging and connecting and stuff like that, which is what this program is really all about. It's about connection. It's about never being alone. Because I can tell you, when you're alone, all sorts of spiritual diseases form from that. And when you're not alone, when you can have that relationship, they talk, see to it that your relationship with Him is right and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. When you can have that relationship, you're never alone, and marvelous things happen as far as your transformation as a human being. And growing up is a big deal. But in any event, that night, 3 o'clock in the morning, I'd been kicked out of a party, and the way I remember it is, and I don't remember much, you know, I mean, it's a funny thing, I was thinking about this the other day. I tried to the best of my ability to remember what it was like 30 years ago. Hell, I tried to the best of my ability to remember what it was a year ago, or 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and I tried to the best of my ability to honestly share with you what was happening and what I was feeling. But you want to know something? The truth of the matter is, and here's the truth. I can remember something that happened to me 30 years ago, or 28 years ago, or 25 years ago, and I can honestly as I can try to share with you how I felt and what the emotions are, but here's the truth. That was 30 years ago. That was 25 years ago. That was 10 years ago. I am not that person today. Now, I'm not saying I'm cured or I couldn't. I'm saying I'm just, my mind ain't there. And I'm just not there. And that's why newcomers are so important to me. Because the truth is, I really don't honestly really remember what it was like. I mean, I remember what it was like, but I can't even bring myself to remember what it was like unless I have a guy with one day or two days in front of me talking about what he's going through in an A room, and then all of a sudden, as he's telling me about his desperation and how he can't stop drinking, all of a sudden something clicks in my mind and I say, man, I remember when it was like that for me. But the truth is, without somebody who's new, without somebody with 1 year or 5 years or 10 years, whatever that is, tell me their experience, I really don't remember. I mean, I sort of remember it. I'm not lying. I'm telling you what I'm saying. But to really feel it, I really need you. And what I realize now, the way this crazy thing works, that we have Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm doing the steps now at the Little River Group, and I just realized this. It's funny. It's so great, you know, to have time and be teachable. And because I'm, you know, God is revealing crap to me every day, and that's what's exciting. I can't wait to see what I learn. And all this, you know, some of the stuff He reveals to me is such simple stuff. It's stuff that's in front of my face. You know, it's been there all along, you know, and I just see it. It's not really complicated stuff. You know, I just complicated myself. And I was doing one of my step meetings, or I was saying something. I can't even remember. That's the problem when you get a little over 60, you can't remember anything. But I can't remember what I was saying, but I was saying something. It was a throwaway line. It was like talking like I am right now. I didn't plan it. I just said something. I moved on, and like the next meeting, this guy came up to me and he said, you know, when you said, and then he said something I said. I didn't even remember saying it, to be honest with you. Yeah, I mean, it had something to do with my story. He said, when you said that, he said, you know, it changed my whole concept about this thing. I can't tell you how much it helped me. And what I realize about this deal right now, and why if we have 100 people in here, why you got 100 different meetings going on. You got 100 different meetings going on about 100 different things, you know what I mean? And one person will say, what was that meeting about? And one person will say one thing, another. You know, I've done enough speaking engagements, so I know people come up to you and they say, man, when you said this, it really helped me. Another guy comes up, when you said that, it really helped me. When you said, and they're all talking about different things. You'll talk for an hour, and each one will remember like one line. But that one line will be enough, and it's the only line they need. And what I realize now is as I'm talking about my experience and my strength and my hope and what happened to me and spewing forth all this stuff and what's going on in my brain, you know what I mean, as far as what happened to me 10, 15, 20 years, what I don't realize, what I never understood, I don't know why because it's so simple, is that out of 100 people in the audience, of 150 people, or whatever it is I'm talking to, there's one guy that's going through that thing that I went through or something very similar to it right now, tonight. See, I'm talking about something that I went through 28 years ago, and he's going through that thing tonight. And like all alcoholics, anybody ever gone through anything in AA? You know what I mean? Gone through stuff? 3 o'clock in the morning stuff, you know, think about it 15,000 times stuff and you still don't get it, you know. What is that deal when you think about it once and try to figure it out and it makes you feel bad and you can't figure out what the deal is, so you figure, and the more you think about it, the worse you feel, so you figure, well, I'll just think about it some more. You know, you ever do that deal where you can't stop, you know, you somehow know, somewhere into it, you sort of know you're never going to figure it out, it's just making, but you can't stop thinking about it because you're a thinkaholic, you know, and that's the nature of the disease, selfishness, self-centered, but in any event, so what I realize now is when we get into that mode where something's happening, where we feel threatened, where we're scared, where the fear, the corrosive threat that's going through our lives is going on, one of the things that happens to us as an alcoholic, as part of the alcoholism, is we just know that nobody will understand us. We just know that nobody's ever been through this before. We just know that there's no use even talking to somebody about this because they couldn't possibly understand. Nobody could possibly have the answer. You're not even sure you could possibly even communicate. And we also know another thing, we're going to die. I don't care what it is. We're going to die. At the end of any fear is death. It's never probation. You know what I mean? I don't care what it is. You know, the IRS is going to get me on the taxes, and then this is going to, and then I'm going to die. We horribleize everything, and it's never going to go away, and it's always going to be like. And then to come to an AA meeting in the midst of having a problem where we know we're going to die, where we know nobody will understand this problem because nobody's ever had this problem and can appreciate this problem. And some bozo gets up here and starts talking and talking and talking about it. All of a sudden he hits the exact problem because I am convinced that we're all twins. I mean, it's only our, I know there's going to be guys in here who say, well, that's not true. We're all different personalities. After 30 years, I've decided, this is my theory, I don't know whether it's scriptural or it's in the book or anything, that we're all absolute twins. We're exactly alike. And the only thing that tells me, well, I'm really different than you or really not the same or something like that is my ego, who wants to think that I'm different. But when it comes right down to it, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, whatever it is, whatever emotion I've ever felt, somebody in here has felt it. Whatever problem I've had or shades of the problem, you've had it. Whatever I've said to myself in the back of my mind, you've said it. Whatever I've ever thought, you've thought or you're capable of thinking, maybe at different times or different ways. I mean, the same, there ain't no different fears, there ain't no different emotions, there ain't no different nothing. Some a little bit more, some a little less, but it's basically the same deal. So if I can honestly be transparent and share my stuff and tell you my stuff and everything like that, somewhere along the way there's going to be some guy in the audience, just because we are exactly alike. Well, at least the men are. I've changed the theory. Men are exactly alike. And we're not like women. Although they can get something out of what we say, but I absolutely believe there's a difference. There's a different template there. But not a bad one, just different, just a different one, you know. But you know, I can say my stuff and something like that, and some guy in the audience that's going through the exact thing when I say that throwaway line, where I'm honestly trying to share something that happened to me 20 years ago, but I'm not necessarily, you know, all of a sudden it hits them like a ton of bricks, because somebody's talking about the exact problem they're going through now that they're convinced nobody can understand, and I'm putting words into it. I'm saying, you know, someone, I survived and I worked out that thing. And that's the way this deal works, you know. And so I got down on my knees. All I remember is I got down on my knees. It was 3 o'clock in the morning, and they had some evangelist on. 30 years ago, they had like an evangelist on, and I gave my life to Christ, which is not a big deal, you know, when you're desperate and everything. But it's a big deal for a Jewish kid from, you know, Redneck New York, you know. So, and sure, you think it's funny, you don't know what it's like, but in any event. I'd like to be able to, you know, I wish I could tell you, like, five guys came down, you know, with some donuts and said, we got an A group going on. I didn't stop drinking. I kept on running, you know, and kept on going. But I did that. I got that on my knees, said the sinner's prayer. There was something the way this guy talked. He was giving testimony. You know what he was doing? He was doing an A meeting. I don't think he knew he was doing that. You know, now I've got to tell you something. And you don't have to, this has nothing to do with you. So don't, if you want to put some sort of label on this, think I'm trying to, you know. You know, we all change. You're going to change. You stick around, you know, now I'm 30 years sober. I got a wife of 30 years. I got 4 children I raised. I got 6 grandchildren. I'm a deacon in the Presbyterian church. You got to watch out for those televangelists, you know. And, and now I go to a lot of Bible studies, and I start a Christian ministry where, you know, where that's who the higher power is and all that sort of stuff, when you study the Bible and the big book and everything like that. And I now realize for the first time that the entire Bible was basically stolen from the big book. You know, so I mean, now that I've studied a lot, I know that deal. That's a whole other story, but in any event, So in any event, so that's what I did. I got up because this guy was telling about who he was and what he was and what he was going through and how bad it was and how he gave his life to, you know, and then everything changed and all sort of stuff. And I was ready to do anything. You know, my Joe Snyder told me he says, Russ, don't rob an alcoholic of his desperation. Never rob an alcoholic of his last drink. Man, I'll tell you, I have a way of sponsoring people. It's just my way. I don't think it's a unique way. I think it's the way I was sponsored. I don't chase after people. I like the Dr. Bob and the Bill Wilson way. When he went, if you look at the Alcoholics Anonymous number 3, he says they came to see him. They gave him the story straight out, and he says, we're not trying to talk into anything. Do you want what we have? We're willing to give it to you. Do you believe in God? And he says, no, you don't want it. We won't. This is what they said. If you're not interested, we won't be wasting your time. And we'll be looking for somebody else who is interested. And I've always thought what they were really saying is, if you're not interested, we won't be wasting our time. So I don't waste my time. You know, I have guys that call me up and say, you know, you sponsor me, right? He says, but you never call me. I said, why would I call you? No, why would I call you? You're over the age of 18. You're a grown man. You want what I have, right? I don't want anything you have. Why would I be calling you up? Now, that may not be right for you. You know, maybe you need to mother somebody, or, you know, maybe you need to treat them like babies, or maybe you need to, whatever you need to do. But what I heard is this is a deal. If you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're willing to take certain steps. Then you're ready to take certain steps. And I wouldn't want to try, I'll tell you what I don't want to do. I don't want to hurt somebody by denying them what they need to do in order to get well. I don't want to be like a codependent and try to drag them to meetings and force them to do the steps and give them all sorts of exercises and cry and beg them and spend hours on the phone with grown men who have the bodies of 30, 40, and 50 years old and still doing the same thing that crazy 18-year-olds or 11-year-olds are doing. You know, I'm here to grow men up, not to treat them like babies, like they're in sixth grade. So, you know, I mean, this is the way, you know, all I know is this. The way I made it, you know, listen, my sponsors abused me. I was an abused sponsee. So I became an abuser, it's true. It seems to me that whenever, and this is a man thing, I don't think it's a woman thing. I was told a long time ago, you can't treat women the way you treat men. You know, men, the men I sponsor, you know, they're ready to fight. When they ask you to sponsor you, that's fight. What they're really saying is, let's fight. So this is why I figure if I'm sponsoring somebody, one of us is going to drink and it ain't going to be me. You know, and they want to argue and stuff like that. And you know, all I know is when I was sponsored, whenever my sponsors would teach, they would say like nasty things to me. Because I had such an ego, I had such a, whatever it is, you know, whatever they call it, you know, inferiority complex, whatever that deal is. I remember my first sponsor, this is some of the stuff they used to say to me. My first sponsor, I took him into my office because I have all these degrees and all this sort of stuff, you know, because I was brilliant, right? And I told him about all my degrees. I showed him all my degrees, postgraduate degrees and all that sort of stuff, departmental honors and this, and national science that. And he says, you know, and this guy never even graduated high school. He was a used car salesman. I was terribly under-sponsored. You know, Albert Einstein was busy at the time. And they caught me while I was desperate, you know what I mean? Because 3 weeks after I got on my knees and gave my life to Christ, you know, I was in a hospital after running my car like into a wall or something like that. And on a hospital gurney, I said, God help me. And all of a sudden something happened, and I'm not going to explain to you what happened, but something happened. And like a day later, I was looking this guy in the eye, and I said, I need help, I can't stop drinking. Now, I used to say, I need a girl, I need money, I need help, I need a job. But that's not what I said that night. Somehow, some way, I was able to connect the fact that my life was unmanageable, and I was going to die, and I needed help, and it had something to do with drinking. I was able to make that connection. And that's what I said. I said, I need help, I can't stop drinking. That's how I did the first step. And this guy took me under his wing, and he was a used car salesman, he didn't even graduate high school, and of course, after a couple of days, I felt a little bit better. I started explaining to him how brilliant I was and all my degrees. And he says, this is what he says to me. He says, you know, Russell, rectal thermometers have degrees. And you know what they do with those? Now, I was 31 years old when I came in here. I had been an A student, graduated departmental honors in mathematics, a law professor. I was the division chief for the attorney general, the one gal for Janet Reno. I was trying murder cases, trying to put guys in the electric chair and everything. I had attorneys that worked for me and everything like that. I was one of the division chief prosecutors. And I can promise you this, I had never had anybody talk to me like that or said that to me. I didn't even know what to make of it, you know? Because where I came from, the Ballywick, I came in here, if you had degrees, you were wonderful. That was the whole thing. It was all about prestige and degrees. And I got this and I got that. And it didn't impress him at all. I didn't impress any of my sponsors. He's the one who also said to me, he says, because I tried to explain one day, I had figured it out mathematically that I didn't have to go to meetings on Thursdays. I don't know. I just figured out because you have to have balance in your life, you know? Somehow along the road, after you have 2 weeks, in order to get out of meetings, you start talking about balance. I know about balance. I would go into a bar at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I would walk out of the bar at 4 o'clock in the morning. 12 hours of drinking. That's just one day, okay? That's my idea of a balanced life, you know what I mean? So I'm trying to cut out meetings on Thursdays, an hour meeting on Thursday, so I can have balance because I don't want to get too crazy about this thing. And he looks at me and he says one of these lines. He says, Russ, you know as much about life as a dog knows about his father. And they probably say that in West Virginia, wherever you're from. But I'll tell you, I've never heard anything like that in my life. I had to try to figure that out. What does that mean? Because I started picturing that RCA dog, a little RCA dog that looked in the speaker. I started picturing a doggy family. There's a doggy daddy, a dog. Because I had to start picturing the dogs. Because I came in here, I had like two neurons working. They were waving goodbye at each other. So I wasn't doing too well. So this is the only way I could figure it out. You know as much about life as a dog knows about his father. So I had to start picturing the doggy father relationship. And it's just, so there's a daddy dog, and there's a mommy dog, and there's a couple of baby dogs, And then all of a sudden, midway into it, I said, wait a second. A dog doesn't know his father. I realized I thought he was maybe complimenting me. You know what I mean? And this was my whole relationship with my, and I'm going to tell you one last story, because I got to stop at 9:15, because we're going to give out the medallions and everything. You learn so much. I was talking to some of my sponsees today, today about this deal. And out of the mouth of babes, and I love men. I love sponsoring men. I love working with the men I work with. I was talking to James tonight, where I'm going to give him a medallion about this thing and how it works. I'm a big believer in lunch. I mean, just my theory. I have the lunch theory of Alcoholics Anonymous, lunch and dinner. If you can't have lunch with me, you can't stay sober. That's just the theory. Guy will come up and he says, okay, I want to work the program. What do I do? I said, well, come down tomorrow. We're going to have lunch. He says, no, yeah, I understand. I can't do it tomorrow, but what I really want to do is I want to work the steps. I said, I understand. We'll come down and have lunch. He says, well, I can't make it down. That's too, I always have these guys. After I drive 50 miles to come to a meeting, I drive from Southgate to come here. I drive like 45 miles to come here. And I get here, and I do my meeting, and then some guy comes up to me, some bozo comes up to me and says, will you be my sponsor? And I always say yes, because I never say no, because I'm available. Because that's what God is interested in. He's not interested in ability, he's interested in availability, because I'm available, because I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. So I say yes. After driving 45 miles, he says, yes, I'll sponsor you. And he says, what do you want me to do? I said, well, come down to this meeting, I'll be down there, we're going to go have lunch. And he says, boy, that's far. And I look at him, I say, yeah, I know it is. It's far. Maybe it's a little too far for you. Maybe I'm not the right guy. It was far driving up here, and I guess it'd be far for you to drive down. You know what I mean? But I mean, how far would you drive for a drink? I mean, that's how you separate the wheat from the chaff. I mean, you will be sifted, believe me. All the horse shit, all the sincere, because alcoholics are incredibly sincere. We even buy our own bullshit. I really mean it. I'm really going to do it. Until you got to drive 40 miles. And then all of a sudden, man, that's far. There's a lot of things that are real hard when you actually have to do them, Like child support, I mean to pay up the child support, and everybody agrees you should pay child support, but man, putting that check in the mail is so difficult. Even though you meant to do it, And there's a lot of stuff like that going around. So one of the things that we were talking about today is about lunch. Oh, I have a lunch where a bunch of guys I sponsor, we get every day I'm eating lunch with 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 guys, 12, 13 guys, whatever it is. We eat dinner together, we eat breakfast together, and every once in a while I eat dinner with my wife, and But here's the point. The point is, and James said it, and it was so true. He says, although eventually you work the steps and you do all that sort of stuff, because if you want what we have, you will do it, and you will figure out a way of doing it. We were talking about him and me when we first started sponsoring, and he's no different than a lot of other people who stick around and stay sober and do this thing. You may call your sponsor 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 or 15 or 2,000 times during the first month or 2 months or 3 months or whatever it is with all sorts of problems. But after you've had lunch with your sponsor about 50 times and you've seen how he talks to other people about the problems, see other people interacting, you've interacted with 50, you sort of like, unless you're brain dead, you get the understand. You sort of almost know. He's like in your brain, like my sponsor. You know how he thinks. You know what he's going to say. You can almost repeat it. As you're picking up the phone, you're saying, I know what he's going to tell me. I says, forget that. I'm not going to do it because I know what he's going to say. He's going to say this is bullshit, you know, and move on or something like that. And then maybe 6 months from now, down the road, you know so well what he's going to say. You call him up only when you have like real big problems. And then the closer you stay with these people and your sponsor and these other people that you want to have, the more you really start getting into your DNA. You start learning to think like they think. You know, it is true. You lie down with dogs, you get up with fleas. Somebody told me, he says, the man you'll be 5 years from now will depend upon the people you hang out with and the books you read. And let's face it, the books I read really depends on the people I hang out with. And the truth is, to a certain extent, you do get this by osmosis. Remember that story? Remember that thing? What was that movie, Kung Fu? Where the guy says, grasshopper, you know, when you can grab the thing from my... When you can grab the thing from my hand, from my... The stone from my hand. It's the same thing over here. He says, you know, you hang around with these people that are farther down the road, like I hung around with Lou, like I hung around with Joe, and you sort of understand what they respect. You understand what they don't respect. You understand how they think. You understand how they don't think. You understand what they value. You understand what they think is bullshit. You hear them tell you a million times how you're supposed to think and how you're supposed to do things. And sometimes it's not sweet and nice. It's like, why don't you shut up? You're so full of shit. You know, why don't you go out and drink? You know, sometimes that's the way they make a point. But if you know anything about guys, it's like I was telling James, you know, to a guy, you tell a guy, you know, you say, I don't know how this works. So I'm not saying this with every guy, but the guys I sponsor, I look at them and I say, listen, you are the most pathetic piece of crap. You know, if I hear you're whining one more time, I'm going to throw up. You know, why don't you go drink? And what they hear is, he loves me. He loves me, you know? But if I tell them, if I say something like, no, I'm really worried about you and I really care, they say things like, this guy's so full of shit. I ain't never listened to this. I don't know why that is, and I don't know what the mechanism is this. I know if I say that to a girl, it doesn't work that way that well. You know what I mean? It's a whole different deal. But that's why I don't sponsor women. Don't sponsor women, guys. So, in any event, so I'm going to do a 30-second, a one-minute story, and then I'm out of here. So about my sponsor and how much I learned from them. I was driving with Bob Sullivan to Broward County to pick up somebody from Bark. When he sponsored me, he sponsored a guy named Bobby. I know this gets a little confusing because his name was Bob and he was sponsoring a guy named Bob and he was sponsoring me. He was like one of my littermates. And I picked up a white chip I never drank again. I'm not taking credit for that. I lay it all in God's hands. I'm not saying I'm smarter or brighter, just the way it is. It never happened. I never drank after that. I've slipped in all sorts of other different ways, but I've never drank after that. But Bobby was one of these guys, like every 30 days he'd drink. He would go to meetings, he would get well, and then 30... And you ever hear anybody in a meeting saying, it's coming up on that time again? You know, I got 10,000 white chips and they all always drink at that time. You know, you get the thing where it's just that 30 days, it's like a countdown. It's like they're talking themselves into, it's like, you know what it is? You know what it really is? It really is an excuse to drink because it's not their fault. It has nothing to do with them. It's that time. It's the 30-day thing. It's the 30-day crap. It's the 30-day curse. They got to drink. It's out of their control. You can't blame them because they got the 30-day or the 90-day, whatever that thing is. But in any event, you know, I was stark raving sober, and, you know, as a sober guy, you know, I was getting a resentment every 5 seconds, you know, listening to people at meetings, you know, what they were saying, what they weren't saying, and all sort of stuff. And I started resenting the fact that we had to keep on, this guy kept on drinking. So I'm in a car with my sponsor, we're driving up to Bark to pick him up for the 10,000th time, and we do the same thing. You pick him up, give him some money, give him a job, take him to meetings. Bobby would swear that he's going to do it right this time, he's going to drink, thank you, Bob, and then go out and drink again. And I was real upset because, you know, the guy was a phony, he was full of shit, he was dissing my sponsor, he was disrespecting my sponsor, and I knew my sponsor, even though he had 15 years, was stupid, didn't understand what he was going on, and I had to save him because he was buying into this crap. And so we were driving up to pick up Bob, and I'm doing, you know, alcoholics are upset, they're upsettable, you know, I didn't know this until many years later. But we get upsetable, we get anxious about stuff. And so I, all of a sudden I turned to my sponsor. He had 15 years. I think I had, you know, who knows what I had, 9 months. And I said, I can't believe you're picking up this guy again. This guy is a phony. This guy, and I had, you know, I'm a lawyer, so I'm a trial attorney. So I had chapter and verse. I said, we picked him up then. We picked him up this. I went through every single time we picked him up. I went through everything he said, everything he promised, all the promises he broke. And I went through the whole list. I had all the evidence. I had 3x5 cards. I had glossy photos. I had everything. And I said, this guy is a phony. He's a liar. He doesn't care about you. He doesn't care about me. He doesn't care about anybody. He's not like, he says, you ought to turn this car around and back up and go away and let him just die there. You know, forget about this son of a gun. And, you know, I probably repeated it about 10 to 20 times. You know what we do when we get an emotional jag? We get ourselves all crazied up. And you know, he let me run, and he went like that. And then finally, when I was sort of like, I had said it for the fourth time, I sort of run down, he looked at me and he said, are you finished? And I said, I really wasn't, because I was still going. You know how that is? It's hard to slow down a locomotive. I was arguing now with my brain, you know. And I said, yes. And he said, no, Russ. He says, are you finished? I said, yes. He says, are you finished? I said, yes, I'm finished. And then he said this to me. He said, Russell, listen to me. It doesn't bother me like it bothers you. See, I hit him with A logic, and he hit me with A magic. I looked at him and I said, how could it not bother you? Everything everybody does in the entire planet drives me nuts. And this is actually happening around you and to you, and it didn't mean anything to him. You know, it didn't mean a thing to him. It didn't bother him. You know, because he had, you see, that's the whole point. Because he was sober. Because that's what sobriety is all about. It's not only about not drinking. It's not being restless, not being irritable, not being discontented. And that's what this program and the relationship with God will give you. So thank you very much, and happy birthday. Have a great birthday celebration.